From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pittsburgh, California.
Oh, I'm not from the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
San Jose.
Coming up, we'll take a look at a proposition that's unique to San Francisco.
So if they're taxing the amount of money people make, they're going to try to find ways to make that money elsewhere.
Then voters in Berkeley are debating whether to outlaw sitting on sidewalks. San Francisco has some insight.
It's a conflict where you got the merchants and the residents versus the hippies and the homeless, and we're kind of right in the middle.
And the swinging pendulum of California prison politics.
This generation, lock them up, throw away the key. The next generation comes behind that one, let's rehab them.
We're getting political today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. With less than 2 weeks to go before Election Day, San Franciscans have a lot of issues to consider, and some are unique to the city. For example, San Francisco is the only city in California that bases its business tax on a company's payroll. Basically, that means if your business makes more than $250,000 a year, your tax is based on how many employees you have, not how much money you make. Proposition E would change that. It would phase this tax out and institute a new one based on a company's gross receipts, which means the total amount of money it brings in each year. Proposition E has gotten a lot of support with unanimous approval from the Board of Supervisors, restaurant owners, and Mayor Ed Lee. Lee's been campaigning hard for this change, arguing that it will bring more jobs to the city and tens of millions of dollars in extra revenue without hurting small businesses. So is this true? We asked Melissa Griffin, who's a political columnist with the San Francisco Examiner, to break it down for us.
One example of a company that is going to really benefit from a gross receipts tax is a company, let's call it a biotech company, right? They're developing a drug, and they've gotten some seed money from some investors or a hedge fund or something, and they're employing a number of well-paid people, engineers, doctors, PhDs, to develop this drug. They don't have anything in the way of gross receipts, right? Again, they're not making any money. They're just developing this thing. But under the current system, under the payroll tax system, they're having to pay payroll tax on the number of people they're employing. And so that's an example of a company that under a gross receipts tax would be much better off because, again, because they're not really creating much in terms of gross receipts, their tax burden goes down or is eliminated from that perspective. In contrast, a company that has few employees here but creates a lot of money and a lot of wealth is going to be sort of punished by a gross receipts tax. So take, for example, Visa, who just recently announced that they're moving out of the city. And I think that there were a lot of factors, but I can't believe that this wasn't one of them. They have a small number of employees in San Francisco, but they generate a lot of money. And under a gross receipts tax, that money is what's going to be taxed, at least to the extent that it can be tied to San Francisco somehow. That money is going to be taxed, as opposed to the current system where they're paying a smaller amount because it's based on just the amount that they're paying their handful of people who are here. So It's larger financial institutions are going to be hurt by this, potentially, those kinds of businesses with fewer employees, far bigger profits and revenue generation are the ones who are not going to be happy about this.
And Mayor Ed Lee has gotten a lot of support for this proposition, but he argues that it's actually a net positive for the city. So can you explain sort of the arguments for and against and who's come out sort of on either side?
Well, of course, the argument for it is that whatever you tax, you get less of. So if you tax per capita payroll, then the conventional wisdom is that companies are hiring fewer people in San Francisco to keep that number down. Mm-hmm. For example, like I said earlier, the payroll tax only kicks in at $250,000. And so anecdotally, we've heard that companies try really hard to stay under that amount and to hire as few people as possible and pay them as little as possible to stay under that $250,000 mm-hmm. threshold. So moving to gross receipts gets away from that and gets away from, like I said, punishing people for hiring San Franciscans. In addition, the conventional wisdom, although we don't really have specific evidence of it, is that Ron Conway's influence with Mayor Lee is also a really big driving factor here. As you know, Ron Conway is a Silicon Valley investor who is the kind of person who makes his money by propping up companies, investing in them to either, you know, to create various technological innovations. And so the companies that he wants to invest in, as I said earlier, that are, they're not going to necessarily create these revenues, that are going to have to employ a lot of people, are the exact kind of companies that are going to benefit from this.
And what, who has, I understand that the Libertarian Party has come out against Prop E, and I'm really curious about these businesses like Visa or these high-grossing businesses with fewer employees. Is there a potential loss in that, in that part, you know, losing those businesses?
That is an absolute concern. And you'll see marketing companies, for example, and financial institutions, a lot of these old school San Francisco companies, McKesson, Charles Schwab, you know, again, Visa, The Gap, for example, has just decided to expand its IT operations, and they're going to be doing that in Oakland, not in San Francisco. So these sorts of industries that have traditionally anchored the city to some degree are the ones that are concerned about this. And the libertarians, but they do have a point. The theory behind taxing payroll is this. You tax based on the amount of resources these people are using in the city. So mm-hmm. I have 100 employees. I should pay more because I've got 100 people under my roof that I'm employing who are now using city services. So there's a nexus between the amount of city services your people are sucking up and the amount of taxes that you're paying. Under a gross receipts tax, that nexus is broken, and you're really just taxing this amorphous amount of money that is supposedly tied to activities in San Francisco. That's a whole other issue we should get into, which is how you calculate this. But the nexus is broken between the resources and the taxes. It just looks like you're taxing the rich. And not really basing it on anything other than they have it.
So let's bring it back to what voters are going to have to decide. Do you think that there's enough support from voters now to pass this, or does it seem to be struggling in polls?
Well, there's no organized opposition, aside from the Libertarian Party. Mm-hmm. There's no real organized opposition. The only reason why it is not polling in the 90s right now is because people just are generally skeptical of such a huge shift from one system to another. Again, it's really unprecedented. And so even without an organized opposition, people generally kind of give the side eye to this proposal. And so it will probably pass. It won't pass, you know, with 99% of the vote, but it'll pass, I think, with a good majority of the vote, and not because it's a great idea, but because there's no organized opposition to it. The companies that don't want to make this move, it's not very popular to come out and say, we like paying fewer taxes and we don't want to pay more, and by the way, we'll probably leave if you do this. That's not really a good idea from a PR perspective. So I think you get a lot of companies who are just being silent right now, who are going to, after Election Day, recalculate, again, either staying here or growing here in San Francisco. Having said that, you know, the flip side is, ideally, this is going to bring in more tech jobs, and so the drug companies, for example, are going to move here because we'll have a better system.
That was Melissa Griffin, columnist with the San Francisco Examiner. Are you a business owner? What's your take on the payroll tax? Let us know on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Martina Castro. And now we'll drop in on a local issue across the bay in Berkeley, where residents and business owners are dealing with a different kind of economic challenge. Commercial streets like Telegraph Avenue are filled with stores and street vendors, tourists, hippies, and the homeless. This mix has led to tension. Shop owners complain that some homeless people create an uncomfortable atmosphere for customers. Back in 1994, Berkeley voters passed an aggressive ballot initiative that included restrictions on panhandling 6 feet from a business. But after challenges from civil rights and homeless advocates, the city council repealed its own law. This election, Berkeley is once again considering diverting homeless people away from economic hubs. Measure S would prohibit anyone from sitting on commercial district sidewalks from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. It's already illegal to lie down. After a warning, violators would face a $75 citation or community service. As Berkeley residents debate whether to pass this stricter law, they might look to San Francisco. The city began enforcing its own sit-lie ordinance back in March of 2011. KALW's Kyungjin Lee reports on how it's playing out.
It's a sunny Friday afternoon, and I'm driving around the Haight-Ashbury district with Francisco Rodriguez. He's an officer with the San Francisco Police Department. He sees a young lady sitting on the corner of Haight and Cole Streets with her bags. He pulls over and approaches her.
How you doing? You know about the sit-lie ordinance out here?
Am I not allowed to speak?
I can't hear you. What did you say?
Am I not allowed to speak?
Spit?
Spange?
Yeah.
She tells him she and a companion just arrived into town. He tells her she's not allowed to sit on the sidewalk and gives her a verbal warning.
It's only a warning, so.
Cool. Thank you.
Now you guys know. I guess you guys are pretty new to the area or something.
Oh, we're from Missouri, man.
All
right. On vacation from Missouri.
Just take a look at that sheet and then.
Cool. I'm not from here.
All right.
I don't know. I can't sit on the sidewalk. I didn't know it was illegal, man.
San Francisco's sit-lie ordinance makes it illegal for people to sit or lie on a city sidewalk between 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. A citation can be issued only after a written warning. If someone receives two infractions within 24 hours, it turns into a misdemeanor. And since enforcement began last March, San Francisco police have issued at least 306 citations. Just about half of the tickets came out of Park Station, which covers the Haight and its many shops. But an independent report released back in March found 60% of merchants say the law has not helped to reduce loitering around their businesses. Instead, both the police and many homeless people here say the sit-lie ordinance has changed street culture into a cat-and-mouse game. Derek Gomez is 31. He's lived in San Francisco on and off for the past 7 years. He recently came back to the Haight and says it only took a few days to encounter an officer.
I was just sitting down talking to a kid. I was having my coffee, actually. It was literally breakfast, 7:30, 8 in the morning. Had my coffee, just kneeled down to talk to a kid, and a cop just happened to roll up, just assumes that I'm homeless and whatnot. I know at the moment I didn't look homeless.
Gomez says he pretended not to know about the ordinance, and when the officer didn't see his name on a list of offenders, she let him go with a warning. But, he says, the mere presence of cops leaves him on edge.
Even when I see them, I just feel like I'm guilty already. What am I doing wrong for them to come to me already?
As we talk near Golden Gate Park's entrance, two squad cars pull up on the grass about 300 feet away. The officers get out to question someone, and soon after, Gomez notices more cops.
Dirt bikes roll by, two units right now, and a guy walking by us. That's too many cops for this little men of people. That's ridiculous. It's a waste of money. So it's taxpayers' money.
Park Station Lieutenant Mike Kaplan says the dynamics of the neighborhood are changing. That means his officers mostly deal with quality of life issues these days.
Well, it's like the old versus the new. And I guess these homeless folks that we're dealing with are like the offshoot of the old Summer of Love. But then you have what we call the yuppies that are the up-and-comers that are paying the big money for the old Victorians. And so it's a conflict where you got the merchants and the residents versus the hippies and the homeless, and we're kind of right in the middle.
Kaplan and Officer Rodriguez show me the list of sit-lie violators. It's 12 pages long.
These are all the people that have been warned. Mm-hmm. So if these people are in violation of sit-lie, they can be cited.
Yeah. As you can see, they've been cited multiple times.
I see. You know. So how many?
Every time they get cited, they get put on the list.
I see.
90% of all sit-lie citations from Park Station were issued to repeat offenders. Of those, four people received more than half of the total tickets. At least two of them spent weeks in jail after ignoring the multiple infractions. Kaplan says it can take a long time for some people to change, and he thinks punishment can provide the impetus. But Jennifer Friedenbach says the sit-lie ordinance is counterintuitive in its response to solving the homeless problem. She's the director for the nonprofit Coalition on Homelessness.
What typically is going to happen is people are going to get ticketed. They are not going to be able to pay the fine. They're going to go to warrant. and they'll end up doing some jail time. We have about 27% of our jail population at the last look was people who were homeless, who have committed no crimes except for being poor.
The independent report on the sit-lie ordinance found violators have generally not been offered concrete referrals for health care and social services, which is an integral part of the law.
It doesn't mean that the person's going to get services, and obviously they're not going to, because they don't exist, as you know, there just is not the capacity in the system to serve folks.
The only referrals most violators get are to phone services at 311 and 211, printed on the back of the written warnings. Friedenbach says that doesn't help get them off the streets.
There's 37,000 households on the wait list for housing in San Francisco. There's hundreds and hundreds on the wait for substance abuse treatment. It takes, you know, 17 hours a day to try to get a shelter bed, and over half of the people, after spending 17 hours trying to get a shelter bed, are turned away, only to have to start again the next day at 3 in the morning.
Some city officials agree the current system needs improvements. Bevan Dufty is the mayor's advisor on homelessness. While he didn't support the sit-lie measure himself, he accepts the will of the people who passed the ballot measure. But he doesn't think the police should be forced to hand out referrals either.
Cops have laws to enforce. It's they don't have, you know, a whole lot of options.
Dufty points out the sit-lie law is one of many city initiatives to address homelessness. He talks about the Mobile Assistance Patrol Program, or MAP. That transports people between shelters and other services, which gives them more options than just loitering on the streets.
The MAP van drivers and our outreach team are really being blended in a way that I think that people are going to see a difference, and we are going to focus on those individuals.
In the meantime, sit-lie has succeeded in detracting many homeless people from gathering on Haight Street, but it has yet to help solve the problems they face in getting back on their feet. In San Francisco, I'm Kyungjin Lee for Cross Currents.
We'd like to hear your take on the sit-lie law. Join the discussion on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents, and I'm Martina Castro. Over the past few weeks, we've been bringing you exclusive stories from inside some of the state's most secure prisons, including San Quentin. And we've been focusing on the people with the least political power, the inmates. Now we turn our attention to another group within the prison system, and one with considerably more political influence, the prison guards. Since the early 1980s, the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, or CCPOA, has spent millions of dollars in lobbying and campaign contributions. Through its spending, the Prison Guards Union has influenced the outcome of elections and ballot measures, like the Three Strikes Law. Over that same time period, sentences have gotten longer, penalties have grown harsher, and more prisons have been built to hold more and more inmates. KALW's Joanne Marr has been following California's prison overcrowding crisis for several years. She told Cross Currents host Hana Baba that the CCPOA in particular has benefited from the prison buildup.
It started back in the 50s when CCPOA was a very small prison guards union. And then in the early 80s, Don Novy became president of CCPOA. And Novy was very ambitious, and he wanted CCPOA to become a major player in state politics. So he made the strategic decision to devote significant resources into lobbying, into creating political action committees, hiring PR firms, and bankrolling victims' rights groups like Crime Victims United. And so as a result of those efforts, the prison expansion grew by around 500% from the early 80s to a peak of 170,000 prisoners in 2006.
500%.
Yes. And so California added 23 new prisons since the 80s, and they hired more corrections officers. So CCPOA's membership rose from about 5,000 in the 80s to over 30,000 today. And these are dues-paying members that generate probably around $25 to $30 million a year for CCPOA. So It's become a very wealthy union and one of the most powerful political forces today.
Now, politically, they're powerful politically. Which way do they tend to lean? Left or right? Which issues do they tend to champion?
CCPOA supports both Democrats and Republicans. Even though the majority of its membership is Republican, CCPOA as an organization has no political preferences. They tend to support politicians that are sympathetic to their issues, politicians that will support tough on crime legislation and support favorable contracts for corrections officers. And they've had a successful track record. 70% of CCPOA-backed legislation has been eventually adopted by the state legislature in the 80s and 90s. So they've been able to wield quite a lot of influence in Sacramento.
And what kind of legislation has the CCPOA backed on both sides of the political aisle?
The most significant piece of legislation they backed was three strikes back in 1994. Following the kidnap murder of Polly Klass, and fear of crime was at an all-time high among the public, and CCPOA took advantage of that, and it got passed by the public by 60% or 70%, so overwhelming margin.
So they've become so powerful, they're very rich. Why have politicians followed along?
They're basically scared of being portrayed as soft on crime. And in many parts of the state, appearing to be soft on crime is like a death sentence for a politician. And it's because fear of crime has been the public's number one concern in the 80s and 90s. And this has given CCPOA tremendous leverage in promoting its tough on crime agenda and getting its politicians elected. But it's not just CCPOA by itself. They've been part of this alliance with other law enforcement agencies and Crime Victims United. And they've been kind of a united front in pushing their tough on crime legislation. And I spoke recently with Dan McAleer, who's the head of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice. And he described how CCPOA and these other law enforcement groups work together in Sacramento.
A lot of these groups would coalesce around issues. They would support each other. So it wouldn't just be the CCPOA and Crime Victims United. You have the District Attorney's Association, the Police Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association. They would all march in and support each other. And how it works in Sacramento is you have lobbyists. These associations, they depend on their lobbyists. So they'll hire the same lobbyists. And so the lobbyists will organize all these groups together. And so when the day comes for to support legislation, they coordinate their efforts. It makes for a very powerful array of forces. And it's very hard for an individual legislator to take it on, particularly when the California Channel is sitting there and it's filming everything. It's going back to your district and you're sitting up there alone taking these powerful interest groups on. It just probably... Given our current system, it's a little much to expect that someone's going to go up against these groups. Sometimes individual legislators did, but they did it at their own peril, because if you went up against them, the next time you ran, you may have a multi-million dollar campaign being waged against you.
And that was Dan McAleer, who's head of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice. And as Dan was saying, there have been some politicians who've crossed CCPOA over the years, and they've been targeted for defeat. And many of them have lost their elections, and some of them who have survived barely managed to hang on. They've had to pour a lot of money to defend themselves. But win or lose, CCPOA is sending a strong message to other politicians. Look, if you cross us, this is what can happen.
Mm. Well, we're in an election year, and so I'm wondering what influence does CCPOA have in this election when everybody's focusing on the economy and jobs and unemployment? Do you think that crime is still enough of an issue that they would have that much power this election year, or is it kind of on the back burner?
I think that crime is on the back burner. It's no longer the public's number one concern. That's my sense. And so Recently, I'd say over the last 4 or 5 years, CCPOA has been relatively quiet. And in this election cycle, they haven't been very prominent. I know that they've taken a position against the death penalty repeal proposition. What's really interesting to me is that Proposition 36, the three strikes reform, which is on the ballot, CCPOA has not taken a position on that. Very surprising because, as many of you know, CCPOA was the major force behind getting three strikes passed originally in 1994. In 2004, there was an effort to amend three strikes, and CCPOA poured a lot of money into that campaign to get it defeated. And so now three strikes is back on the ballot, and CCPOA is sitting this one out. So that represents a sea change from where CCPOA first started. You couldn't have imagined them taking that kind of position 15 or 20 years ago.
That's KALW's Joanne Marr speaking with Hannah Baba about the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, or the CCPOA. This is Cross Currents, and I'm Martina Castro. There are three propositions on the November ballot that will affect California's criminal justice system and the CCPOA. Proposition 32, which bans political contributions from unions and corporations, Prop 34, which will eliminate the death penalty, and Proposition 36, which reforms the three strikes law. And while that could dramatically change the prison system, change would be nothing new for California's Prison Guards Union. KLW's Joanne Marr explains as we return to her conversation with Hannah Baba.
The political winds are shifting. I think CCPOA realized much sooner than a lot of people that this prison expansion we've been seeing over the last 30 years was not sustainable. And so CCPOA started shifting from its previous aggressive lock 'em up, tough on crime agenda. And I think it started back in 2002 when Don Novy, the president of CCPOA, who oversaw its rise to power, he retired. And so new leadership has taken over, and they made the decision to shift away from this aggressive tough on crime stance. So their recent positions have been downright liberal, pro-prison reform. For instance, they support reentry and rehabilitation for prisoners. They support sentencing reform. They joined the prison law office in their challenge to overcrowded conditions in prisons. And then, as I mentioned, they've decided to be neutral on Proposition 36. I spoke with CCPOA Vice President Chuck Alexander a few years ago and asked him, hey, what's going on with CCPOA? And he told me that this shift we're seeing from prison expansion was kind of inevitable based on historical trends of prisons and their treatment of prisoners. And he gained some historical perspective from this book that he read, written by a prison warden who was in charge of Sing Sing Prison back in the 1920s.
It goes in cycles, and I believe it's generational. This generation, lock them up, throw away the key. The next generation comes behind that one, sees that that didn't necessarily fix the problem, so let's try something different, let's rehab them. Then the generation following that sees that, well, there's still crime, how can that be? We need to lock them up, throw away the key. And I saw that in this book, that in that guy's 25 or 30 year career that he referenced in his book, the New York system from the turn of the century through the 20s went through the same thing that I've seen in my time, a period of lock them up, throw away the key, whatever, beating them with hoses, you know, whatever the variation was, punishment, to, well, let's give them a skill and or thump them with a Bible or whatever the mantra was at the time to rehab them. And so we're seeing that now. But so I think back to the change in CCPOA, I think that's part of that. For a period of time, we were lock them up, throw away the key, and now we're, well, that's not producing the results that are favorable. So let's try something different. Let's see if some of them are rehabilitatable or habilitatable, whatever you want to call it. We're there. Let's give it a shot. Even if we get 5% of them that don't come back, out of 170,000 people, that's a significant number. And at $48,000 a head,
I save money as a taxpayer.
That was CCPOA Vice President Chuck Alexander. And, you know, it's too bad that our attitudes towards prisons and prisoners keep swinging wildly back and forth from rehabilitation to punishment and back again. And I think it's led to the dysfunction we're seeing today in California's prisons. I think it would be much better for prisoners and societies at large to have a consistent prison policy. And prison reform activists like Dan McAleer would like to see a policy that emphasizes rehabilitation, and it's his hope that CCPOA would support a more therapeutic approach towards prisoners.
Mm-hmm. Another big issue regarding prisons, in addition to rehabilitation, is prison overcrowding. Governor Jerry Brown's realignment plan is in the works, and it's about moving low-level offenders from state prisons to county jails. So I was wondering, where does the CCPOA stand in regards to realignment?
CCPOA was neutral when the issue of realignment came up, which was also a surprise because you couldn't have imagined them taking that kind of position 15 years ago. Realignment is probably going to mean a reduction in the correction staff. And so I heard that CCPOA is engaged in a fight to keep as many positions as possible. But it's interesting, when it comes to contract negotiations, I think CCPOA has lost some of its influence recently. In the past, governors and legislators used to routinely approve CCPOA's contracts, which were very favorable. They usually contain generous wage increases. So today, the average salary for a corrections officer is $73,000, which is way more than your average prison guard makes in other states. And it exceeds the salaries of your average classroom teachers. It exceeds the salary of assistant professors teaching at state universities and colleges. So CCPOA, I think, has lost a little bit of its leverage because fear of crime is no longer the number one concern. And so you're seeing politicians starting to push back on CCPOA. And you saw that happening in the Schwarzenegger administration. Arnold Schwarzenegger was not willing to give in to CCPOA's demands. And so CCPOA has been working without a contract since 2006. I heard that CCPOA and Governor Brown are close to reaching an agreement, but I also heard that this new contract is going to include furloughs, which amounts to a 5% pay cut, and the prison guards are going to have to contribute more to their pension fund. So these days of generous contracts seem to have come to an end for now, and that's one example of how CCPOA seems to have lost some of its clout. And what's interesting is Proposition 32 on this November's ballot, it would prohibit labor unions from using member dues for political campaigning. If that passes, I think that could potentially have a great impact on the amount of political influence CCPOA is going to exert in Sacramento.
That was KALW's Joanne Marr speaking with Hannah Baba. You can find links to Joanne's previous reports on the CCPOA and follow up on all of our prison coverage on our website. It's kalw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Erica Mu, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Maya DePaula Hanica, Archims Konohoffs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Anna Sterling, and RJ Sloan. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City CarShare, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City CarShare is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. This is the soulful sound of Mary Stallings. She played with Dizzy Gillespie at the Black Hawk Club in the 1960s. And tomorrow night, she's headlining her own show at Herb's Theater. It's part of the San Francisco Jazz Festival. You can find details at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Martina Castro.